Good evening. The public charge rule targets immigrants. A congresswoman talks about life under occupation in Palestine. And why is there homelessness in the world's richest city? With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Tuesday, August 20th, 2019. And in breaking news, New York Attorney General Letitia James filed a lawsuit this morning against the Trump administration's public charge rule, which aims to deny green cards and visas to immigrants that use or have used government assistance programs. Elected and community leaders across the state of New York came out and expressed their support for the lawsuit. And in response to Trump's move on Tuesday at 6 p.m., that means at this hour, Congresswoman Yvette D. Clarke is hosting a district town hall at Brooklyn College to educate the community on the importance of the 2020 census, immigration policies, and immigrants' rights, including how to apply for citizenship, the citizenship process, and information regarding standby guardianship. Clark spoke with WBAI moments ago about the effects of the public charge rule and the need for the public to avoid panic.
This is part and parcel of what has been an onslaught from the Trump administration and Donald Trump himself to, you know, marginalize and to really push back on the notion of immigration in our country, and particularly those immigrants who are coming from, nations of color. You know, the policy that you were referring to is what is called the public charge rule. And this is a law that, a regulation, quite frankly, that's been on the books for quite some time now, for several generations, as a matter of fact. But it has never been used as a means test in the way that the Trump administration is using it as through its proposed rule, which would go into effect in October. That's just one in a line of really egregious anti-immigrant actions and policies that the Trump administration has been, just battering immigrant communities with ever since he was elected. And it's unfortunate. So we've got to do a lot of educating in the public. And the 9th District is home to a number of mixed status families, very large populations of mixed status families. And the last thing we want people to do is to act hastily out of fear, not knowing whether in fact public charge would be applied to them, whether in fact they are eligible for other types of relief. And so it's important that we get accurate information out into the public about knowing their rights as immigrants and what is being applied to them and what isn't.
So this is about fear in a lot of ways. This is about fear in a lot of ways. This is about the president of the United States and the government trying to instill fear on people in this country as part of an anti-immigrant agenda. Would you say that?
Absolutely. I would definitely say that this is an anti-immigrant agenda, and that part of it is fear. Part of it is just cruelty. And you know, it's going after the most vulnerable in our society.
What should people do to find out more information?
Well, I'm hoping that they'll reach out first of all to their members of Congress. My concern, and one that I voice frequently, is that there are those who would use this climate and this opportunity to scam immigrant families out of hard-earned money. To get accurate information, to know their status, what their rights are given their status, they should really reach out to their elected representatives who, by virtue of the service they provide, would give good guidance, as opposed to word of mouth individuals, guiding people to unscrupulous characters and nefarious characters who are scamming immigrants because of the climate that's been created.
Congresswoman Yvette D. Clarke. Italy's prime minister resigned on Tuesday after launching a blistering attack on his own interior minister, Matteo Salvini, accusing him of sinking the ruling coalition and endangering the economy for personal and political gain. Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte, addressing Parliament after it was recalled from its summer recess to decide the future of the 14-month-old government, accused the far-right League party chief Salvini of seeking to cash in on his rising popularity. Meanwhile, an Italian prosecutor ordered on Tuesday the seizure of the open-arms migrant ship and the evacuation of the migrants on board, ending a prolonged standoff between the Spanish charity and the government in Rome. The open-arms ship, run by a Spanish charity of the same name, has been stranded at sea for the past 19 days, with the charity saying that the migrants are distressed and urgently need to find shelter. Italy has taken a tough line on migrant entry, saying it has borne too much responsibility for handling African migration to Europe. Interior Minister Salvini says the charity-run ships have become taxis for people smugglers. Spain and five other European Union nations have offered to take the migrants. The details of the offers from Spain, France, Germany, Romania, Portugal, and Luxembourg have yet to be finalized. Meanwhile, residents of Sicily have been risking prison to bring aid to the migrants escaping mostly from Libya. Since December, the Italian government has removed humanitarian protections for the refugees. The government has threatened massive fines to the Sicilian fishermen who are helping the migrants. And at least 2,300 people, mostly young men, have been detained in Indian-administered Kashmir during a security lockdown and communications blackout imposed to curtail unrest after New Delhi stripped the disputed region of statehood. That's according to Kashmiri police. Those arrested include anti-India protesters as well as pro-India Kashmiri leaders who have been held in jails and other makeshift facilities. The crackdown began just before Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist-led government on August 5th stripped Jammu and Kashmir of its semi-autonomy and its statehood, creating two federal territories. Kashmir's special status was instituted shortly after India achieved independence from Britain in 1947. And Russia has resumed sharing data from radiation monitoring stations in Siberia after some were taken offline following a deadly explosion at a missile range. The Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization said earlier this week that several Russian radiation monitoring stations went silent shortly after the August 8th explosion at the Russian Navy's testing range in northwestern Russia. Russia's State Weather and Environmental Monitoring Agency said the peak radiation reading after the accident was 16 times normal. A source told WBAI, the reading was actually 20 times normal radiation levels. The Russian military said the explosion killed two people and injured six, while the state nuclear corporation Rosatom acknowledged later that it also killed five of its engineers and injured three others. Rosatom said the explosion occurred on an offshore platform during tests of a nuclear isotope power source. And yesterday, the United States tested a Tomahawk cruise missile launched from an island offshore of California. It was the first launch of a missile since the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty was abrogated by the United States earlier this year. In Washington, Representatives Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib held a news conference on travel restrictions to Palestine and Israel, days after Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's decision to block the two congresswomen from entering Israel. Tlaib recounted the humiliation of Palestinians attempting to enter their homeland at the hands of the Israeli military.
As a young girl visiting Palestine to see my grandparents and extended family, I watched as my mother had to go to dehumanizing checkpoints. Even though she was a United States citizen and proud American, I was there when my city was in a terrible car accident, and my cousins and I cried so she could have access to the best hospitals, which were in Jerusalem. I remember shaking with fear when checkpoints appeared in the small village of Beit Ur al-Foka, tanks and guns everywhere. I remember visiting East Jerusalem with my then husband and him escorted off the bus, although he was a United States citizen, just so security forces could harass him. All I can do, as my city's granddaughter, as the granddaughter of a woman who lives in occupied territories, to elevate her voice by exposing the truth the only way I know how. as my Detroit public schools teachers taught me, by humanizing the pain of oppression. Our delegation trip included meetings with Israeli veterans who were forced to participate in military occupation. They also desperately want peace and self-determination for their Palestinian neighbors. They could have shed light into injustices of raids, shootings, demolitions, and child detention. The delegation would have seen firsthand why walls are destructive, not productive. They could have asked the people in Bethlehem how walls cut people off away from economic opportunities, from a way to live, and do psychological damage that lasts forever. All I can do as her granddaughter is help humanize her and the Palestinian people's plight. I know that when we can finally see them as deserving of human dignity, everyone who lives there will be able to live in peace. It is unfortunate that Prime Minister Netanyahu has apparently taken a page out of Trump's book, and even direction from Trump to deny this opportunity. And yes, while folks are shocked that this happened to us, but today we will hear from folks who will help show the reality for many who have been barred from going into Israel, not to be even able to reach the Palestinian people. They are fellow Americans who cannot visit their families or their loved ones. They should be all of us should be deeply disturbed. All of us Americans should be deeply disturbed. And with that, I then thank you so much to my colleague, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, for helping humanize the Palestinian people.
A Jewish American resident of Tlaib's Minneapolis district represents the group, If Not Now, that opposes occupation of the West Bank.
My name is Rosa Druker. I am here as a constituent of Congresswoman Omar, and I'm here as a young Jew. My Jewish values call me to defend the freedom and dignity of all people. It is because of these values that I organize with If Not Now, a movement of American Jews working to end our community's support for the Israeli military occupation over millions of Palestinians. The situation may be complex, but it is not complicated. The occupation is a daily nightmare for those who live it, and a moral disaster for those who support it. What we saw this past week demonstrates Israel's desperation to hide the realities of the occupation from us. Palestinians are denied access to medical care, education, economic opportunity, and freedom of movement. The Israeli government receives billions of dollars from the U.S. annually to enforce this cruel regime. When the Israeli government denies entry to our democratically elected members of Congress, they show us that they have something to hide. When American politicians try to silence Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, they are complicit in supporting the occupation. When political leaders peddle hate and sow mistrust, it impacts us right here in Minnesota, where we have seen an increase in hate crimes. When the political right tells Jews to fear progressive leaders like Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, they are weaponizing anti-Semitism for their own gain. I refuse to let my Jewish identity be used as a tool to incite Islamophobia. I reject the narrative that anti-occupation means anti-Jew. All of us should demand human rights for Palestinians. I stand by my congresswoman in demanding accountability from the Israeli government. I stand by her in the face of racist Islamophobic attacks by those who seek to pit my Jewish community against Muslims. That strategy will not work. We know that the real threat to our communities is white nationalism. The same ideology that motivates anti-Semitism motivates Islamophobia. It is only by standing together against these attacks that we can build a better world.
Meanwhile, on Tuesday, Trump suggested Jewish Americans who vote for Democrats either lack the requisite knowledge or show what he called great disloyalty. Democrats called Trump out for his use of the word disloyalty. Haley Seufer, the executive director of Jewish Democratic Council of America, said in a statement, at a time when anti-Semitic incidents have increased due to the president's emboldening of white nationalism, Trump is repeating an anti-Semitic trope. And you're listening to the news on WBAI, listener-sponsored radio in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. On Monday, a jury in Manhattan handed down guilty verdicts against two members of a white supremacist organization known as the Proud Boys. Maxwell Hare and John Kinsman were convicted of multiple charges of attempted gang assault, riot, and attempted assault. They face up to 15 years in prison when sentenced in October. The charges grew out of a fight with an anti-fascist group known as Antifa outside of a speech by Proud Boys founder Gavin McGinnis at the Metropolitan Republican Club on East 83rd Street last October. The Antifa victims of the assault refused to cooperate with DA Cyrus Vance's office, but the victims were identified in the indictment as shaved head, ponytail, khaki, and spike belt. The defense theorized during the trial that Vance was in cahoots with Antifa. Prosecutors referred to McGinnis as a hate monger. According to prosecutors, the Proud Boys, led by the defendants, sprinted 100 feet to attack the anti-fascist protesters. Seven other Proud Boys pleaded guilty. One more is awaiting trial. Also on Monday, NYPD officer Daniel Pantaleo was fired by Police Commissioner James O'Neill 5 years after he administered a chokehold that killed Eric Garner on a Staten Island street.
The consequence of Mr. Garner's death must have a consequence of its own. Therefore, I agree with the Deputy Commissioner of Trial's legal findings and recommendations. It is clear that Daniel Pantaleo can no longer effectively serve as a New York City police officer.
Garner's last words, "I can't breathe," became a rallying cry of the Black Lives Matter movement. His mother, Gwen Carr, thanked supporters but added more officials needed to be punished in the death of her son.
I thank you all for coming out with the support that you have been giving me for 5 years. It's been five long years that I have fought this fight. I have not fought it alone because many of you have been out here with me. Many of you have been here from day one.
Yeah.
Like Minister Kirsten John Foy said, he was with me from the beginning.
That's right.
Reverend Sharpton with me from the beginning.
Yes.
The Justice Committee, CPR, and many of you who's out here from the beginning, who helped me fight this fight, who helped me get to this point. I could not have done it without you.
That's right.
Thank you.
We love you.
We fought and fought to get the NYPD to give us a file number so the CCRB would bring charges against Pantaleo. We fought that fight for a couple of years, and then what they do to try to appease us, they give it to us on the anniversary, on the fourth anniversary, the eve of the fourth anniversary of my son's death. That was supposed to appease us. Well, let me tell you, it didn't. It just made me more angrier. And it just put more fight into me.
All right.
You know, I had a lot of stumbling blocks that has come up to me, but I'm not stopping this fight.
That's right.
There's many of my family members who has been taken away from me since I started this fight. Many of them you don't even know, but you do know my granddaughter, Erica.
All right.
She died the day before New Year's Eve. In 2018. It was just, I'm sorry, it was 2017. Then just a few weeks ago, I lost my husband, who stood here, and he stood in this very spot with me. He was over here in Police Plaza with me while we went through that long, drawn out, that trial. We had to wait because Pantaleo's lawyer wanted to go on vacation or take 2 weeks to bring in his expert witness, an expert who never even examined my son's body, who never even seen the report.
That's right.
Now he wants to tell us that it was not a chokehold. How would you know and you never looked to see what the evidence was or was not? But you know what? Pantaleo, you, your regime, London, y'all can appeal all you want.
That's right.
But I'm still out here. I'm out here for the long run. You come out here against me, I'm out here. And you cannot scare me away. Yeah, Pantaleo, you may have lost your job, but I lost a son. July 17, 2014. I lost my son.
Yeah.
You cannot replace that. You can get another job, maybe at Burger King, okay? So, But, you know, it's just disheartening to go through this. And like we said, we're not finished. We have other officers that we have to go after. You have heard the names. We know the wrongdoing that they have done. So I would like the press to put it out there. Show the pictures, say the names,
yes.
Do the roll call,
right.
Because they all need to lose their job.
Right.
New York is not safe with officers out here like that.
That's right.
These officers are still on the payroll. Pantaleo was supposed to be on desk duty, making six-figure salaries. Put me on desk duty. Give me a six-figure salary.
There you go.
You know, but no, other New Yorkers can't get that.
That's right.
If the shoe would have been on the other foot, my son or myself, we would have long been sentenced.
That's right.
Probably
to life
or probably they'd have brought the death sentence back.
Right.
Who knows? But you know what? I don't care what they do, who they appeal to, even though Commissioner O'Neill said that his decision can't be overturned, but we know that it's going to be a fight out there, and I'm out there for the fight. I just want y'all to fight with me.
And that was Gwen Carr. In more local news, Coalition for the Homeless and other members of the House Our Future New York campaign held a press conference and rally on the City Hall steps Tuesday, urging Mayor de Blasio to commit to building 24,000 new apartments and preserving the affordability of 6,000 more for homeless New Yorkers by 2026. Giselle Ruthier is policy director of the Coalition for the Homeless. She says homeless people could become a thing of the past if only a political leader had the will to take on the job of building low-income housing.
What we did today was rally on City Hall steps with our partners from the House Our Future campaign, and we've been running this campaign now for over a year to put pressure on the mayor to devote a greater portion of his Housing New York plan to homeless New Yorkers, which makes intuitive sense, but also is imminently doable and will actually help address record homelessness in New York City. So specifically, we've been asking for him to build 24,000 new units for homeless New Yorkers as part of the plan and preserve the affordability of at least 6,000 more for a total of 30,000 units. That's 10% of the plan. It's frankly a modest goal, but it is much, much more than what he is currently doing. Right now he's setting aside just 5% of his plan for homeless New Yorkers, and most of those are preservation units, which will not be available for occupancy for currently homeless people because they're already occupied by someone living in them. Really laying out why some of the arguments that the mayor has given about why he can't do this, why those arguments are wrong.
Why are they wrong?
So the main thing is that he talks about when we say add more homeless units to your plan is that he says my housing plan is for everybody and everybody needs affordable housing, when in fact the data show that not everybody is experiencing the same problems with affordability in New York City. And we actually have a very bifurcated housing market in New York City. So we have a glut of apartments that are renting above $2,000 a month. There's a really high vacancy rate for those apartments. It's not a problem for people to get those apartments on the private market. And yet the mayor's plan is subsidizing those units, but fully 10% of his plan is subsidizing units above $2,000 a month. That's twice as many units as are being created for homeless households. At the other end of the spectrum, we have very few apartments available for the lowest income households and homeless New Yorkers. And so what we're really showing here is that the market dynamics are perpetuating homelessness, and we need the billions of dollars that are invested in his housing plan to be targeted to those most in need.
Now, I know you're not the mayor, but isn't he embarrassed a little bit? I mean, you know, I talk to people from all over the world, and people who come from countries that are not nearly as rich as the United States can't get over what they see when they come here. It's shocking to them. Doesn't he understand that the homeless problem in New York is affecting how people see the city all over the world?
I would hope that he understands that, but certainly his rhetoric around saying that he thinks he's done enough is really not indicative of him really caring about the problem, and that's unfortunate. And something that's really goes against his initial campaign promises when he ran for mayor to address the tale of two cities. So we've named our policy brief the tale of two housing markets because those problems are persisting, and he, as mayor, is not addressing them.
So New York City goes on as the world renowned as the city of homeless people living in the streets.
And in shelters. So the other, you know, one important point to take into account is that in New York City, we do have a right to shelter. So that means most people who are homeless in New York City are in the shelter system, which makes it a little bit more invisible of a problem. Of course, we still have thousands of people on the streets, but we've got tens of thousands of people sleeping every single night in the shelter system. We've got over 60,000 people every night in the shelter system. So it is absolutely, we have more homeless people in New York City than any other city in the country. It's the biggest city in the country with the most homelessness. And it's a problem that we can't continue to ignore.
Every mayor, conservative and liberal, has said they can solve this problem. None have been able to do it. Why is it so intractable?
The problem is it's not intractable, and the solutions are simple, but they need investment. The solutions are housing. The solution is housing. It's that simple. So we need to actually invest in building housing. We need to invest in housing vouchers. We need to invest in supportive housing for people with serious mental illness. And all of those neat things. Now, where we've reached this point where we have so much homelessness in New York City, they need to be invested in at an extremely bold, high level in order to make a difference in the number of homeless New Yorkers' lives. And so we need that investment. We know what works. A lot of times politicians are really focusing on the short-term victories or Band-Aid solutions, but we need them to think longer term and think bigger.
Giselle Routhier is Policy Director of the Coalition for the Homeless. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, August 20th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.
On Tuesday, August 20th at 10 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl asks communities to stay, fight, and build as we talk to Vivian Vasquez Irizarry, director and producer of Decades of Fire, which looks at the policies of racism and neglect that still shape our communities while offering hope for today. We'll also talk to Moikansi Gama of Image Nation, who will screen the film on August 23rd. That's Tuesday, August 20th at 10 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
The WBAI Local Station Board Town Hall Planning Group is meeting on August 21st at 7 p.m., and you're invited. It is at the Wall Street Atrium, 60 Wall Street in Manhattan. You are invited to participate and share your ideas. That's 7 p.m., August 21st, at the Wall Street Atrium, 60 Wall Street in Manhattan. See you there.
The 2019 local station board elections are underway. Visit elections.pacifica.org for candidates' written statements, video cards, and debates. As of August 15th, your ballot will come in one of three forms: an email ballot, a brightly colored postcard, or, if you requested it, a paper ballot from Honest Ballot. If you cannot find your ballot, please fill out a ballot request form on elections.pacifica.org. Members in need of a paper ballot can leave a voicemail at 510-854-9663. Paper ballot replacements will be issued through October 7th. All ballots must be received by October 15th, 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to be counted. It's 99.5 FM WBAI in New York and online at WBAI.org.
All right, so this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online. For the life of me, I don't understand why I just went high on that voice when I just went on mic, but hey, it happens. I guess this is what live radio is supposed to be. And just to remind listeners out there,